translated as the shorter discourse on ways of detecting things. This is Sutta number 45 in the Middle Length Discourses, starting on page 405. Okay, so the title, the Shula just means smaller or shorter, and Dhamma can have various meanings. Animal Dhamma just uses the most general meaning of things, and Samadhana means to take up or to undertake. And so these are actually describing four ways of conduct. And in these two suttas, this one and the following one, you get a very clear example of how the Buddha, when laying out his teaching, he always uses a very systematic framework, you know, laying out the different possibilities and then showing the different consequences to which the different possibilities lead. Okay, so here he opens the discourse by saying that there are four ways of undertaking things. What do we say? Four modes of conduct, four ways of behaving, four ways of undertaking action in the world. Okay, so the four are different permutations, basically, of the two ideas. So whether a course of action, one idea is whether a course of action is pleasant or painful. The other idea is whether its fruits or consequences are pleasant or painful. So we could say the basic framework is that's pleasant now and ripens in the future as pain. taking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pain. So first the Buddha takes the two courses that have painful consequences. One is pleasant as one is performing it. The other is painful as one is performing it. But what unifies them is that both issue in future suffering. Then there are the two ways of behavior that issue in future pleasure or happiness. One of these is painful now, and the other is pleasant now. So painful force and the pleasant force that issue in future happiness.
Themselves to groups of male wanderers
When darkness would fall, they would have a bit of fun in the woods. And so these ascetics and Brahmins say, what? But there are some ascetics and Brahmins who speak about abandoning or renouncing sensual pleasures, and they describe the full understanding or the overcoming of sensual pleasures. And so they say, what harm do these good recluses and Brahmins see in sensual pleasures? And then they continue, they say, pleasant is the touch of this woman wanderer's tender, soft, downy arm. And so they take to gulping down sensual pleasures. Now, because they're living supposedly a life of renunciation, they should be committed to a life of brahmacharya, that is, a life of celibacy. And yet, even though they're displaying themselves to the public as renunciates, and they're being supported by the people, by the public, with the expectation that they're living lives of renunciation, lives of celibacy, but still they are indulging in worldly sensual pleasures. And because of this, it seems that they are deceiving people and supporting themselves with the deceit by deceiving people. And so this is considered within the context of the Indian society, a kind of deception. Maybe if we were to take a counterpart, maybe I'll leave the imagination, what would be like a counterpart in contemporary American society? You know, what would this be?
Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's a bit of a strong example, but it is true.
He was Pema Chodron's teacher. He was real. Really bad.
He didn't make any claim to be a self-absolutist. In fact, I think he was at least, he was maybe given credit that he was quite open about what he was doing. No, I don't know what the consequences of his actions would be. But I'm thinking not so much, or not necessarily about sexual enjoyment, but there are other preachers and teachers who make other claims and then behave quite differently.
Oh, televangelism.
Exactly, that's what I'm thinking of. Who, you know, Christian preachers who preach the gospel and tell their followers that one should be living according to the teachings of Christ, living a life of simplicity. But they themselves live quite luxuriously. And actually, many of these preachers even turn the teaching of Jesus around. And they have what they call it, the gospel of prosperity. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
You know, that you should try to get as wealthy as possible because that's a sign that you will be one of the chosen, one of the elect. If you are prosperous, you belong to the elect. And then, of course, you have to donate a certain percentage of your earnings to the church. And so they will have big mega churches, and they will drive around in, it used to be Cadillacs, but I don't hear people talking mostly about Cadillacs anymore.
Mercedes.
BMW.
Hummers.
What is it?
They don't make them anymore.
Hummers.
Oh, they've been out of commission for a year.
Is it any part of the book?
He did.
Yeah, and then also there are some of these homophobic preachers, you know, say, oh, the gay people, the lesbians, they're all going to hell, God hates them. And then about 6 months ago, there was in the Miami airport, somebody took a flash picture of one of these preachers. Maybe he wasn't a preacher, but he was the head of one of these Council for Family Values men, who was most vociferously opposed to homosexuality. And there he is at the airport with a handsome young man that he took to vacation in the Bahamas, supposedly on the ground, that he just came out from the hospital and he needed somebody to carry his luggage.
Yeah, you're not religious.
He wasn't a preacher, he was a politician. And also he did good work. He should still be a governor. If he was still a governor, perhaps it would have been more severe pressure on Wall Street. Okay, so they do this, they freely indulge in sensual pleasure, and then the text says, after death, they reappear in a state of deprivation and an unhappy destination. One of the bad destinations in perdition, that's the lower world, even in hell. And there they feel painful, racking, piercing feelings. And then they say, this is the future fear, the future danger that those good recluses and Brahmins sought in sensual pleasures when they spoke of abandoning sensual pleasures. For it is by reason of sensual pleasures, owing to sensual pleasures, that we are now feeling painful, racking, piercing feelings. What do you think of this? Yeah. Anybody else have any thoughts?
Karma.
I mean, it's supposed to be the result of karma. Supposedly he would be able to see, you know, with the divine eye, what happens to them after death. Does it seem fully justifiable for what they're doing? Can you be bored with that?
Maybe not so much what they're doing, but how they're presenting themselves.
Yeah.
The consequence of that is suffering.
Well, even the Buddha was able to turn his life around, right?
Yeah.
He's always a choice.
Yeah.
It's more about the deceit.
Maybe so, yeah. But I have to say, from my point of view, it seems a little, well, I'd say more than a little, it seems like an extreme consequence of an action like that. It's quite a different case if you have, say, a Catholic priest who is seducing and molesting a young boy, he's, you know, maybe 10, 12, 13-year-old boy, who's not able to judge for himself and who will just accept the authority of the priest and do whatever he says. Maybe the priest is even threatening him with divine retribution if he doesn't yield to the priest's desires. But in the case of, in the setting of indulges with a mature woman, to say that he's going to be reborn, that she will be reborn, but how is the consequence of that? To me, it seems rather strong. I could say an unhappy rebirth, like a rebirth in hell. Normally I would reserve the hell for those who really inflict suffering on others. Not that I want to sort of second guess the Buddha, but just using sort of my own intuitive sense of what kind of action should lead to what kind of consequence.
But there's a lot of that in the Pali Canon, the really extreme things. Supposedly, the Venerable Ananda, in one of his many past lives, was naughty and got stuck in hell for, you know, innumerable palpas. And, oh yeah, I'll look it up on Access to Insight. I remember reading that.
Is it Ananda or Mahamogalanda?
No, it was Ananda.
Oh, the silent Ananda.
I'll have to look it up. I'll get better on Access to Insight. But there's a lot of examples of extreme, you're going to hellness.
Yeah, after that's a
good actors thing. Might go to hell, you know.
Yes,
ma'am. Well, I guess two things come to mind. I mean, first, I know it's not meant this way, but when I read something like this...
Maybe take the microphone.
When I read something like this, even though I know it's probably not intended this way, I mean, I see it on a mundane level of if you overindulge in anything, you're going to have painful consequences. If you drink too much, you're going to wake up with a hangover. If you eat too much, you're going to be in pain, etc. So on that level, you know, you're kind of moment to moment reborn in hell, certainly.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, I think you just said something interesting about that you would reserve the hell levels for people who have done harm to others,
especially.
But are we ourselves included among others? I mean, if you do severe harm to yourself, is that equally worthy of a rebirth in hell? So, I mean, if you are, you know, punishing your body with excessive behaviors, punishing your mind with excessive vile thoughts or whatever, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. In fact, the next course will be those who inflict pain upon themselves, you know, by taking up the ascetic practices, and the text is going to assign them to hell. But I don't think it doesn't seem likely that the karmic cause for that rebirth of hell is undertaking the ascetic practices. Because the Buddha himself had, according to the text, had undertaken those same ascetic practices. And there's some things in the text, I have to say, are I find difficult to understand or to make sense of.
Are these things related to the Buddha or is this meant to be literal or just keep society in some sort of check?
The way it's stated, if you just take some text on the surface, it seems to be literal, because it says, on the dissolution of the body after death. But it can't be that there's sort of an underlying purpose or agenda is to keep other ascetics and maybe his own ones to keep them in check.
I think it's more spreading of the wrong will instead of indulging the sense of worship.
Actually, that's a good point. He said that the main point is rather spreading the wrong view. So propagating the view, that's actually going to be a very good point. That the point, the deed that brings about strong negative karma is propagating the view to others that there's no harm in sensual. Not the fact simply that he's stroking the arm of the woman ascetic with the top hat on her, but propagating this view. That could be, yeah, that seems to be the point for me. Anyway, let us go on. Okay, now the text gives a simile for this. It's a very vivid simile. And I've seen this myself, actually, in Sri Lanka, not with deities, but with trees. Okay, creepers and trees. Suppose that in the last month of the hot season, a bough of a creeper had burst open, and then a bough of a creeper seed fell at the foot of a sal tree. A sal tree is a very large, strong, majestic tree that grows in South Asia.
Okay, then a deity living in the tree became frightened by this, but the deity's friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives to other types of deities, came around and they said to him, "Don't be afraid, don't be afraid. Perhaps a peacock will swallow this malava creeper, or a wild animal will eat it, or a forest fire will burn it, and so on and so on. And it might not even be fertile." Okay, but none of this happens, and then the rain falls, and the seed of the creeper gets moistened, and then the creeper sprouts and starts growing. It's a soft, tender, soft, downy tendril. Starts wrapping itself around the sal tree. Then the deity living in the tree says, "What future fear did my friends and companions and so on see in that malava creeper seed when they gathered and reassured me? This malava creeper, the tendril, is very soft and pleasant." Okay, but the creeper wraps itself around the sala tree and makes a canopy over it. Then it drapes a curtain all around the tree, and then it splits the main branches of the tree, and then maybe the tree comes tumbling down. And so then the deity who was living in that tree realizes, so this is the future danger that they saw in the malava creeper seed. Because of that malava creeper seed, I'm now experiencing painful, racking, piercing feelings. And what I've seen in jungles in Sri Lanka, there are these kinds of creepers that grow up. They're very small, and they just look like an ordinary weed, but they grow next to a tree, and sometimes they grow within the fork of the tree and the branches. Then they wrap themselves around the trunk of the tree. They'll send down roots into the ground, and then that creeper will start growing and become bigger and bigger, stronger and stronger, until sometimes it will suck up all of the nutrition out of the tree, and the host tree will die. And sometimes it will become so strong, the creeper, that it will actually split the tree, and the tree comes falling down. Okay, so this illustrates the case of these ascetics and Brahmins who indulge in the sensual pleasure. Okay, next comes the way of undertaking things that's painful now and ripens in the future as pain. Okay, so here we have the case of an ascetic who goes naked, rejecting any kind of the ordinary conventions of everyday life. He doesn't use any utensils when he eats, but he licks his hands. He doesn't wash his hands. Actually, in India, everybody uses their hands for eating. Nobody uses spoons, forks, except people who have been come under the influence of the British imperial, the British Empire. But ordinary people will use their hands for eating. But they'll always have bowls of water so at the end of the meal that they wash their hands. Okay, then the text will enumerate a whole variety of ascetic practices, like reducing the intake of food. Jill was just eating a few grains of rice per day, sleeping on beds of thorns, exposing oneself to the heat of the sun, to the cold of the nights, and so on. And so in this way he dwells, pursuing the practice of tormenting and mortifying the body. And then on the dissolution of the body after death, he is reborn in a state of misery, an unhappy destination, in the lower world, in hell. So that's the way of undertaking things that's painful now and ripens in the future as pain.
constancy of life, maybe seeking enlightenment, liberation. It's just that he has wrong guidance, and so he thinks that the way to enlightenment is through engaging in these ascetic practices. And even in India today, there are ascetics who engage in simpler practices. I remember back in 1975, when I was in India, and I think we were coming back from Lumbini, still on the Indian side of the border, or going into Lumbini. Just before we reached Lumbini, we were in this little town to catch the bus that was going to right to the Nepal border. And there came an ascetic. I remember he was naked and walking on all fours and stopping in front of the shops, waiting for people to throw him food, just like he was a dog. And then I already read at this point the Majjhimanikaya. I thought, wow, this is just like, it's called the Dawn Buddhi aesthetic, described in Sutta number 57 of the Majjhimanikaya. I thought, wow, 2,500 years, and it's still going on today. I didn't follow that dog aesthetic to find out where he's going to be. He seemed to be a bit older than myself, so it's likely that he's not alive anymore. I don't have any idea where he's been before. But okay, so that's the way of undertaking things that's painful now because of the ascetic practices and ripens in the future is pain. But I would certainly say that a practice like that is not likely to bring pleasant result, even though the idea of a rebirth in hell seems to be too severe for my personal judgment. Okay, what is the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure? Okay, here somebody by nature, just by the character of that person, has strong lusts, strong raga or passions, and he constantly experiences pain and grief or pain and misery born of lust. By nature he has strong hatred, again by nature strong delusion, and he constantly experiences pain and grief born of delusion. And yet, while experiencing this pain and grief, even while weeping, shedding tears, he leads the perfect and pure holy life. Then on the dissolution of the body after death, he is reborn in a happy realm, even in the heavenly world. So this is called the way of undertaking things that is painful now and ripens in the future as pleasure. And so sometimes people think that everybody who leads a monastic life is in some way has a very pure, noble, well-developed character. But many people who still have strong defilements, but their wisdom eye is open to some extent, and so when they hear the Dhamma, they can be so inspired by it that they decide to go forth and to lead the life of renunciation as a monk or a nun. And yet, these passions, because one becomes a monastic, doesn't mean that the passions immediately vanish. But even while practicing very diligently, very sincerely, there will be times when these defilements or passions come surging to the surface so strongly that the person might think, I can't withstand them anymore. I'll give up the monastic life and return to the household life. And this happens with a great number of those who go forth. Like in a country like Sri Lanka, it's quite typical for young boys, you know, when they're 12, 13, they have a kind of romantic image of the monastic life, or it used to be a tradition, to some extent it still is, in devout Buddhist families, when they have a large family with several sons, they will take one of the sons and they say, to offer him to the triple temple, to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, which means to give him to the monastery, become ordained as a monk. And so if the young boy, the age of 12, 13, he has these romantic images, romantic ideas of the renunciate life, it's I'm going to be sitting deep meditation. By the time I'm 17 or 18, I'm going to be a spring mentorer, once returner, non-returner. By the time I'm 21, I'll be an arahat. And then he goes walking on arms around through the streets, very calm, self-controlled. He's strange, very mindful. People say, oh, look at the young monk. Bow to him, very impressed. When he gets to be 16 or 17 years old, you know, the hormones start splashing through the body. And, well, maybe not at once. Maybe not an arahant of this life, but certainly extremely thorough. By the time he's 18, he's struggling to remain. By the time he's 19, he can't take it anymore. And when he gets to be 20, he comes to his teacher and says, Bhante, I want to give up the monk's life and return to the home life. There are many cases like this. I mean, in Sri Lanka, I would say that of the young boys in the monastery who are in their teens, by the time they get to be 30 years old, maybe only a third of them will still be monks. That's the way it is. And even the elder monks know that's the case. But it's like, if we're going to keep the Sangha going, we have to take our chances. You know, we have to ordain 100 young boys so that we could have 30 of them still monks 20 years later, 15 years later. If we limit our number to 15, then 30 years later, 15 years later, we're going to have only 5 boys left. But there are others who, whether they're ordained when they're youngsters, or ordained when they're in full adolescence, or even as young men, young women, when the passions come up like this, strongly coursing through the mind, they make the effort to restrain them, even with difficulty, thinking that I've pledged my life to follow this path. So despite the difficulties, I'm going to continue with this training. So even though they have to endure a lot of pain and suffering now, actually if they continue like this over time, the passions will weaken to the point where they develop calm and equanimity. And then eventually, as a result of persisting in new training, they're creating a lot of false karma that will bring a happy stages of realization. Okay, then the fourth way of undertaking things, or the fourth way of practice or training, is the one that's pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure or happiness. Okay, here we have the case of somebody who, by nature, is not strongly prone to lust, hatred, and delusion, and to the contrary, he is able to fairly easily enter and dwell in the four jhanas. The text doesn't speak about him going further beyond the jhanas to develop an insight, so it's a mundane teaching. But if he is able able to enter and dwell in the jhanas, then with the breakup of the body after death, then he will be reborn in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. And both the one who practices with pain and difficulty, and the one who practices with pleasure and with joy, both of them are capable of going beyond a happy rebirth to reach the stages of enlightenment and liberation, even though that's not mentioned explicitly in the sutra. Okay, any questions or comments on these four ways of understanding this? Yes.
Thank you.
sometimes I find Malthus's
books.
Comments about insightful. Sometimes he goes to the extreme.
我现在开 QuickBooks 2003 在我的旧电脑上
It's on the internet, Bonte, I've heard that
Okay, good, it doesn't matter if it's easy. I had a correspondence with him back in the late 1990s about in that the book they wrote, How Buddhism Began, and they just claimed that the Brahmaviharas were just a metaphorical expression for the achievement of nirvana. Then I compiled all the... Okay, then I wrote a book review of that book.
Wait.
And I criticized him at that point. In England, it was published in the Buddhist Journal, saying that there is a very high-bound traditionalist American monk in Sri Lanka.
Open company?
And
you add open company, you have some notes as well.
The horrors are a metaphor for nirvana. Then I wrote it in.
不对，open company 怎么回事？ 应该是 open a company, 它是一个 dialogue box 出来。
Coming from the Nikayas in which the Buddha speaks about obtaining the Brahma Viharas in an earlier life and saying,
不是，你按 file， 然后有第一个 file 下面第一个是 new company， 第二个是 open company， 第三个是 open previous company， 对不对？
To dispassion, to enlightenment, to nirvana. But now,
QuickBook， 然后你打开 QuickBook， 你要把里面所有东西通通关掉，能关掉通通关掉。
I sent it to him. I never got a reply from him. But then I took a look. I don't have a company.
No company open， 然后呢，然后旁边有一个 open 有没有？你就按 open 就好了。
And I saw that he's still making the same claim. I'll have to track him down. I still have that email.
好，对，不要这个，对不起。然后你就再去按一次 file， 你再去按一次 file。No， 你要按 no， 不要 OK， 要按 no。那你就把那个有没有个叉叉把它关掉？好，一定要 OK 就 OK 吧。你就按 file， 再按 open company。他说什么？叫你去注册，所以你现在这个就是。你还没有注册吗？他怎么会叫你去注册呢？OK 什么？他跟讲什么东西叫你还 OK？
According to the traditional account, the Buddha had his personal attendant was a monk named Ananda. And so Ananda, it said, had an excellent memory. And so he would always follow the Buddha along, and he would memorize all of the Buddha's discourses whenever the Buddha gave them. And
不对，怎么会有一个 company?
If he missed any discourses, he would go to the monks who heard them, learn them.
不是你去按一下 file。
And so after the Buddha passed away, 3 months after he passed away, the
leader. 你 double click 哪里？
The orderly held a council in the city of Rajagaha, and they had Ananda recite all of the.
你的 icon 在哪里呢？在桌面上的吗？
They all
memorized
under Ananda. Breaking up into different companies, specializing in different groups of texts.And then they would train their disciples to memorize them. And so this way the teachings were transmitted for 300, 400 years until finally in the first century BC they were written down in Sri Lanka. This is, I would say, partly religious.
通通都不要，它右边有一个 open， 你去按一下 open 就好。
Absolutely, literally. Because there are different early Buddhist schools.
那好，那我跟你讲，你重来一次，你去不要按 open， 你按那个 open and existing company.
Transmitted what is basically the same corpus teachings are fundamentally all the same. And sometimes there are remarkable correspondences between schools that have been geographically separated.
这都不对，这通通不对。 不，我跟你讲，他那个 screen 的左边是不是有什么什么 my recent documents desktop？ 那你刚刚那个 file 现在是存在哪里嘞？那个 zip file 你把它打开了没有？你有没有把它 extract
出来？你有存在？你把
extract 出来了吗？都 extract 了，你已经用 zip file 把它抓出来了，没有留在 zip 里面。 不行，一定要把它从 zip 里面打开拿出来才行。你光 zip 是不行，你要从 zip 里面先拿出来才行。你拿出来了，你现在去拿，你现在去。嗯。
And a text preserved in Sri Lanka. That is supposed to be.
Just extract 到一个 location 出来就好。
This is what he heard.
你到一个你自己能找得到的 location.
Again, this is a little bit not completely trustworthy, but many later texts appear, and to give them all this kind of imprimatur or authenticity, they always begin with the words, "Thus have I heard."
Recently, I was reading about the practices of Benedictine monks in the early period of that order, and monks were supposedly allowed to read one book per year.
你刚刚会过那个应该还没有关掉吧？你刚刚都把它关掉。对，你就回到刚刚那个啊 ，open the company 那个 dialog box
里头。那不过左边它有一个
panel， 最上面写说 my recent document， 然后 desktop， 你现在存在 desktop 里头，对不对？你就去按 desktop。 就 register， 你就去 register 啊。 register number 你有啊，我不是给过你？对啊，你就把它打上去就好了。对啊。
已经registered成功了，是不是？好，成功了，你就再回去再去
open existing file。Open an existing company.
Noble
Path 你看得到，是不是？
Obsessive needs for material or hedonistic enjoyment.
那好了，那你就已经开了。对
呀、
啊，对
呀、
啊，对。
Creating wholesome karma, then as a result of that wholesome karma, one gets reborn into prosperity, and then one gets burdened with all of the luxuries, comforts, and convenience.
你会做哈？你知道怎么做哈？你现在对我啊、对你对可能要。
And if one still preserves in the mind that mental formation of moderation and simplicity, then one could dwell amongst the luxuries.
那个 scholarship 你知道，你还应该是属于 expense， 你知道吧？他应该是，我想想看 ，scholarship 应该算是属于 expense， 对，因为他是一年，他是从我们的 income 里面去掉的。我想想看，哎，也许不应该是 expense。他应该是 expense， 也说的也是，他应该是 expense。好嘛，那你就开一个 expense。对 ，donation 是 income， 对，没有错 ，donation 是 income， 那是 expense， 因为我们没有什么 asset 嘛，我们基本上 asset 就是一个 checking account 而已，我们没有任何其他的 asset， 对。对，对对，那十个 entry 里面，我想唯一没有的 account 就是这个 scholarship 这个 account， 对。四千块钱，对，你去看那个，对，我在我那个 entry 上通通都有，然后我那个后面都有注记是给谁给谁，对，如果你还要需要更多注记的资料，我应该还有，因为后来那虚马是有寄了一个他的那个论文来嘛，就当成我们，我不晓得你要不要注记在里面，那随便你了。对，理论上应该他先写论文才给钱，我给他，我就让他后缴，但是我到时候我是要把它做成是他先缴的。对，是没错。我想，我就是说那个，因为我们现在所有的，我们这个团体很小嘛，所以所有东西通通都是用这个 checking account， 然后通通都用这个 QuickBook 把它记录下来。它记录你在记的时候，它都有一个 note 让你写 note 的地方嘛，就看你自己要把它 note 上去。那因为像我们那个存款啊，那个支票号码什么都有啊，谁捐的钱什么都有写得很清楚嘛。所以反正对，你先做看看，有问题再问我。好，多谢多谢，辛苦你了，拜拜。
The lesson with equanimity. Yes, good comment. In the Bible, God always favors the poor. So I don't know. Is it more to that question?
Seems like he knows who you are. It's the last statement he has. Seems like he knows who you are.
Oh, God knows who the person is. Yeah, the way, say, the biblical God is doing service for Buddhism, the law of karma, that you can't perceive God, according to Christianity, and Buddhism say one can't perceive the law of karma. So one gets the results that accord with one's actions, with one's inner mental state, not with one's external, sort of hypocritical displays of behavior. Any further comments? Questions? I said I would take on two students today.
Well, I think I usually because it was said that sense states that are the sort of consciousness and awareness without sight and recognizing
your own. Well, then you take the microphone.
Yes.
Everybody can.
Consciousness depends on the we classify the sense states of the mind, but
question, but I'm just trying to think whether we're going to have a sutta that will bring up that question. Because it requires a more detailed answer. But I did definitely deal with that question. Who's taking you to Argentina, to Europe, to the Bahamas? You know, even if you go to these far off places, we're on the internet. But if you look, I think I did, was it in this class that I did Sutta number 38?
Yeah.
Yeah. You look at Sutta, the backlog of the points, it will be on New Rome's website. And also on the front, actually on the front end, the Bao's website, Buddhist Association of the United States. The past recordings from the Legend of the Nikaya Sutta, the lectures on Sutta number 38. I dealt with that a bit too. Okay, I'm just going to go through like a quick outline of Sutta number 46. Just the main points. I can't deal with it at length. Okay, we come to chapter or section two. So for the most part, beings, here we can understand people, have the wish that they would like undesirable things to diminish and desirable and agreeable things to increase for them. But even though they have this wish, for the most part, disagreeable things increase for them and agreeable things diminish. So this is like sometimes it can be stated most succinctly that even though people yearn to create suffering and yearn to find happiness, but for the most part they're constantly meeting with suffering, and real happiness proves to be very evasive. And so then the Buddha asks, what is the reason for this? The monks say, you explain, you're the teacher. And so the Buddha then takes first the case of the ordinary person, the uninstructed worldly person, who doesn't know what things should be cultivated and what things should not be cultivated. And so because he doesn't understand this, he cultivates the things that should not be cultivated and does not cultivate the things that should be cultivated. In other words, he doesn't follow the right and wrong courses of behavior, and so he does those things, behaves in those ways that produce suffering, and doesn't undertake those types of action that lead to happiness. In contrast, the wise, instructed, noble disciple knows what things should be cultivated and what things should not be cultivated. And so he cultivates the things that should be cultivated and doesn't cultivate the things that should not be cultivated. And he does not cultivate those things that shouldn't be cultivated. As a result of this, then the undesirable things diminish for him and the desirable things increase. Okay, then the Buddha introduces the four ways of undertaking things in their combinations, permutations, and the same as in the previous system, but they'll be elaborated differently. But rather than explain them explicitly, the Buddha just fills in by saying that the ignorant person who doesn't understand all of these distinctions, he cultivates the way that is painful now and ripens in pain, and he cultivates the thing, the way that is pleasant now and ripens in pain. And because he cultivates these two ways, then the undesirable things arise for him. The reason is because he doesn't see and doesn't understand. Okay, now taking together paragraphs 8 and 9. Okay, again, it's the ignorant, deluded person, doesn't know the way of undertaking things. It's painful now, it's pleasant now, but that ripen in happiness in the future. So since he doesn't have that understanding, he doesn't undertake those two courses. The way that's painful now, the way that's pleasant now, which both ripen in future pleasure or happiness. In contrast, the wise person understands all of these distinctions, and so whether a course of action is painful now or pleasant now, if it ripens in future pain, he'll avoid it. If it's, whether it's painful now or pleasant now, if it will ripen in future happiness, he will undertake that way of action. So this is because this person is wise and has life understanding. Okay, then the Buddha explains the four ways a little differently from the number 45. First, the way that's painful now and ripens in the future is pain. Here, somebody with pain and with suffering violates the 10 courses of wholesome action, or he undertakes the 10 courses of unwholesome action. Killing living beings, stealing, sexual misconduct, false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, gossip, covetousness, ill will, and wrongdoing. And so because of undertaking the 10 courses of unwholesome action, whether with pain or pleasure in the present, as a karmic consequence, those 10 courses of unwholesome karma will bring the rebirth and the state, the deprivation and an unhappy destination in the lower worlds, even in hell. So those are the ways of undertaking things that are painful now or pleasant now, the next one, pleasant now, but they ripen in pain in the future. Okay, the next two courses of behavior, the third and fourth, the actual ways of behavior are the same. Abstaining from, or following the 10 courses of wholesome action. Abstaining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, abstaining from falsehood, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle chatter, having a mind without covetousness, a mind without ill will, holding right view. In one case, one engages in these 10 types of behavior with pain and with misery. In the second case, one does so with joy and happiness. But both, whether one has pain or pleasure, but one engages in them, one is practicing the 10 ways of wholesome karma. And so when that karma ripens, it will bring pleasure and happiness in the future, rebirth in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Okay, then to illustrate each of these ways, the text gives four similes, one simile for each type of behavior. The first is to illustrate a way that is painful now and results in pain or misery. Now, this is one way that I always think to make a distinction, what was spoken by the Buddha, what was not. But when it comes to these very vivid, very lucid, very striking similes, often I get the sense this has to come from the Buddha himself. I could be wrong about that, but there's something so, say, sparkling and illuminating about the similes. that I'm willing to describe this correctly, is correctly concluded. So here, this is to illustrate the way which is painful now and results in future pain. There is a bitter gourd with, I guess, the juice in this gourd, and it's mixed with poison, and a man comes along who wants to live, not to die, wants pleasure, doesn't want pain, and they tell him this bitter gourd, its juice is mixed with poison, you can drink it, if you do so, you'll find your taste, scent, color disagreeable, and after drinking it, you might die or experience deadly suffering. And so he drinks it, he doesn't reflect, and as he drinks it, he finds it has a bad taste, bad scent, and then he dies or meets with deadly suffering. So that's the way of undertaking things that's painful now and ripens in future pain. The next one, we have a bronze cup with a beverage that has a good color, scent, and taste, and it's mixed with poison. The man comes along, people say to him, this beverage, it has a good color, scent, and taste, but it's mixed with poison. You can drink it if you wish. If you drink it, you'll enjoy the taste, but you might die or meet with deadly suffering. So the man doesn't pay attention to their warning. He drinks it, he enjoys the taste, but later he gets sick and he dies or gets very sick. Okay, third case, this is the way which is painful now, but issues in future happiness. Here there is fermented urine. This is cow's urine, which was in India, was regarded as a very potent medicine. And it's mixed with various medicines, different herbs. If you don't like the idea of drinking urine, you could think of any typical, if any of you have taken Chinese herbal medicine, you know that it usually has a very bitter taste. So, a man comes along with jaundice, and they say to him, this fermented urine that's mixed with various herbs, herbal medicines, drink it if you want. When you drink it, you'll find the taste disagreeable, but that after you drink it, after some time, you'll get well. And so he drinks, he reflects on these choices, and then he decides to drink it. And as he drinks it, he finds the taste bitter, disagreeable, but after he drinks it, sometime later, he recovers from his illness. So that's the way that is painful now, but ripens into future happiness. Okay, then there's another drink consisting of curd with honey, ghee, and molasses mixed together. And then a man comes along with dysentery, and they tell him, here is this drink. You can drink it. If you drink it, you'll find it very pleasant to taste. Very agreeable, and after drinking it, you'll recover from your illness. And so he drinks this beverage of curd, honey, and so forth. He enjoys the complete taste, and after some time, he recovers from his illness. So then the Buddha concludes by saying, again with another simile, he says, just as in autumn, in the last month of the rainy season, I mean, this will be like October, you know, when the summer heat has come to an end, and the sky is very clear, dark blue, free of clouds, and you see the sun rising above the horizon, dispelling all the darkness, as it shines beams and radiates. So too, the way of undertaking things that is pleasant now and ripens in the future as pleasure, dispels with its beaming, with its shining and beaming and radiance, any other doctrine whatsoever of the ordinary recklessness and wrong. Okay, any questions or comments on this sutta?
Devices, speech, or speech.
start this